Carl Hyacin has his own unique brand of green initiatives. He uses creative storytelling to craft passionate pleas for saving our state's breathtaking and fragile natural resources. His narratives educate us about environmental perils. More often than not, he shames the establishment about its damaging and damning policies and practices. No one wants to be exposed in a Hyacin column. His greatest achievement is that he helps to give voices to the voiceless, the mangroves and the burrowing owls, the aquifers and the deep blue sea. It is this overarching devotion to preserving paradise that truly sets him apart. Please welcome South Florida's rakish champion of the environment and scourge of the wrongdoer, my very good friend, Carl Hyacin.
Oh, where do I start? Rick Scott. You know, first of all, let me say a little bit about I've been with the Herald for about, Miami Herald for 35 years. 25 of those years, I've been writing a newspaper column. I get to say whatever I want. I'm lucky I work for a newspaper that leaves me alone. Most people at the paper want nothing to do with the column. They don't want to look at it. They don't want to claim they've ever read it before it goes in the paper. So as a result, I have very few editors. And I'm older than most of them anyway, so it doesn't matter anymore. The secretary's optimism about the federal government having to deal with our new governor was somewhat amusing. This is the same guy who only shortly after taking office was interviewed wearing a pair of alligator skin boots and announcing that if it were up to him, they would just shoot the alligators. And this is who is now the custodian of the future of the Everglades in Florida. This is every time I think about giving up the column and just working on these novels that I write, mostly as psychotherapy. But every time I think that the column, you know, why am I even doing the column? Then Florida does something like elect Rick Scott. And how could I possibly sit on the sidelines for the next 4 years? Seriously. Columnists from other part of the country always say to me, you got it so easy, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. How do you invent these guys? Let's talk about the Everglades a minute. Let's be positive. 20 years ago, roughly 20 years or so ago, it was very rare to hear very many candidates for political office ever mention the Everglades. Ever talk about the Biscayne Aquifer, ever talk about the Kissimmee Watershed, any of that stuff. You never heard a word about it because it was all about pouring concrete. And that was the engine of growth in Florida, growth for the sake of growth. We had a philosophy. We had the same exact political philosophy as a cancer cell, growth for the sake of growth. At that time, we exported nothing but oranges and handguns, okay? Now things have changed. Now there isn't anybody running for office, either within the state, statewide office or national office, that doesn't make the pilgrimage to the Everglades, the photo op on the Anhinga Trail. And we're going to see this before the presidential primary. You're going to watch these numbnuts pile into Florida over the next few months. Seriously. And they're, when they get to South Florida, there will be a trip. Someone will give them some khakis to put on, shirt sleeves. They'll loosen their tie. They'll go pose in front of the Chamber of Commerce alligator on the Anhinga Trail, and they will be conservationists for one freaking day, and that's it. Because we're dealing with a mentality right now in Washington, by the way, that questions whether science is viable, whether science is even real or not. Seriously. Seriously. You have people Forget climate change. Forget the very obvious existence of climate change. Just the whole, it's now popular to run on an anti-science campaign. And this is true. We've come to an incredible state in the year 2011 when politics has been reduced to this kind of a discussion, when we know what's happening around us. The Everglades is proof. What changed the Everglades was not a great political awakening. It was not a great renaissance of morality, thinking about what is our duty to this great river, to this great body of water, to our kids and to our grandkids. It was none of that. It was the realization that if we lose the Everglades, we can't build any more cities. The engine of growth comes to a grinding halt because fresh water is necessary for sewer hookups. It's necessary if you're municipalities, if you're a developer, you got to have fresh water. And you're not going to sell many condos when you turn on the tap and salty sludge oozes out. You got to have the fresh water. And everybody got on board then. And the banner of patriotism began to wave over the Everglades. And to this day, now, we get to see it. Everybody, you watch what happens in this next, they'll all be here. Michelle Bachmann will be here. You betcha. She doesn't believe in science, but she'll be down there. She'll be messing around with it. Maybe they'll, you know, a small gator. I was thinking about this because in my novels, if any of you have read, the novels are very disturbing. I'm not a well person, and I'm the first person. I was born and raised down here, and there's no way that I'm going to be normal after watching everything that's happened here. But I've been thinking when I see these sound bites of these googans down there, and they're pretending to be outdoorsy, and I'm thinking, what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about pythons at that moment, because we have these gigantic pythons now everywhere in the Everglades, and I'm just thinking it would be just a beautiful moment. I'm picturing. And I'm not talking about necessarily a fatality. I'm just talking about a couple coils. Just wrap around, take her down. My goodness, would that be fun to watch? And I'm thinking, you know, I mean, I'm not for like Rand Paul, no, because he's older and you don't want him to have to go through it. But I'm thinking some of them are pretty young and tough. They can handle a python event. You got to think like this. In a lot of my novels, what happens in some of the novels is I get to write my own endings. That's the selfish pleasure of a novelist. And any honest writer is going to tell you the big difference between the journalism that you do and the novels that I write is that so often the endings that we have to write in journalism, and the old axiom is that they don't send you to the airport when the plane lands safely. Okay, so we spend most of our careers writing endings that we wish were happier, that we hope the kid is found alive. We hope someone walked away from that accident. But many, many times it doesn't end that way. But in the novels, I get to write whatever I want. So the bad guys, I spent a lot of time thinking about if it was a perfect world, what end would come to this particular person? And luckily, I have editors in New York. Most of them have no clue about Florida. They don't know how close to reality the novels really are, how close to documentary they really are. We're standing right here now in this hotel, the edge of Biscayne Bay, beautiful Biscayne Bay, and there's a giant sewer pipe that runs from the mainland over to Virginia Key. The home of the Rosenstiel School, one of the most prestigious marine schools in the world, the University of Miami. But there's this sewer pipe. It's an old sewer pipe. And it leaks so regularly and so copiously that several times a year they have to close the beaches on the way out to Key Biscayne because there's human feces in the water. And the people of Miami are now so used to this. They're so accustomed to having crap on the beach that you practically need riot police to move people away. You say, you can't swim with that. Well, we've always swum. What are you talking about? It's pathetic, but it's true. In this year, we can't even pump sewage across the bay. Ken was talking about the BP spill. I don't know any of you who have kids, or as I do, or grandkids as I do. During the period that well was leaking, if you sat in a room in front of a television set with that kid on your lap or next to you, watching the live feed of that spill, pumping thousands and thousands of gallons of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico, and you watched those kids' faces and the genuine horror, the genuine disgust, the genuine disbelief that we as a people, as a species, are doing this, that this is happening before their eyes, was in essence the reason all of you out here do what you do. But let me tell you something that's going on right now. I mean, you cannot look at the future generation. None of us are doing writing the way we're writing or taking up these issues that we take up for ourselves. It's all for the future. But right now in the state of Florida, there is an active campaign underway to roll back the water quality laws and to fight the federal EPA toxic emission guidelines, so the state of Florida can ignore them, so the phosphate mines and the paper mills and some of these other businesses can go on gagging us to death. And under the guise of, if you are in favor of clean air, clean water in this country right now, you are a job killer. Did you know that? You like that phrase, job killer? Because you hear it a lot in the rhetoric. We're job killers. Any regulation at all kills jobs. That's the word out of Washington right now. Now, go back to the BP oil spill. There was nothing killed more jobs. Nothing did more damage to the economy of three different states, four exactly, than that environmental catastrophe. And the arrogance of now saying that the restrictions on the oil companies are job killing, when this state in particular, and certainly Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, some of the others, was in a downward spiral for months and months and months after this, is quite extraordinary. It's even more extraordinary that they've been able to sell it. Yeah, let's turn it back over to the oil companies. Let them police themselves. That worked real well. That worked out just great. And we now have an administration that's actually decided that maybe some of the people doing the regulating shouldn't be in bed with the people being regulated. What a novel idea. I was out in Montana this summer. I spent a lot of time out west. And the folks who live along the Yellowstone River in Billings, Montana, were alarmed one day to wake up and find oil in the river, in the Yellowstone River. And they were even more surprised, man, even to find out that Exxon had a pipeline under that river. And only months earlier, this is going to come as a great shock to you, the oil company assured the state of Montana that pipeline was in no danger of rupturing. It was in fine shape. Trust us. Trust us. And then it blew up. In the Yellowstone River. So yeah, let's have a little less regulation. Let's let them run the show again, and you watch what happens to our rivers, and you watch what happens to our air. It can't be done. And as Ken said, the economy of a place like Florida, if you lose the beaches, if you lose the environment, you lose the economy. Not just tourism, but nobody wants to move here anymore. This whole great engine, this great train that everybody's riding, comes to a screeching halt. And the short-sightedness of saying, yeah, let's throw up as many derricks, oil derricks, as we can within sight of the beaches of the Florida Panhandle is insanity. It's sheer insanity. But there is a great movement in Tallahassee to do just that, and they're waiting for all the BP stuff to die down. And I got to tell you something. The folks... And I hope there's no kids here, but I'm going to tell you. I use this line in a column. I'll use it. You're all grown-ups. I have referred in the past to the Florida legislature as a festival of whores. A festival of whores. Okay? I find now I have to apologize to the world's oldest profession. Because these knuckleheads are far worse. They are far worse, and guess what? They are for sale. And they are for sale cheap, and it doesn't take much to buy them. So Why don't I quit the column? Because you don't walk away from a fight, because I was born and raised here, and it sickens me that my kids and my grandkids are going to have to deal with the concept of science as somehow unpatriotic, the concept of a clean beach, of a clean Gulf of Mexico, of the Atlantic Ocean, that we still are fighting for these things, even in my lifetime, is quite astonishing. So I'll stay pissed off, and I'll keep writing a column. let me just tell you something else. Let me tell you something else. A few years ago, I had my editor in New York, one of my book editors, came to me and said, would you be interested in writing a book for children? And I said, have you not read anything I've written for grown-ups? Are you out of your mind? Why would you let a child be exposed to this? And they said, step back from it for a second. You write, the environmental themes are very strong among young readers. The irreverence they like, the humor, they like funny stuff. And I thought about it, and I thought, I've been, my whole professional life as a journalist, I've been making fun of grown-ups. And that's all they wanted out of a kid's book, was to make fun of a grown-up. So I wrote a book called Hoot, which was about, thanks. It was about these little burrowing owls, and it was a page out of my own childhood. It was about three kids who were trying to save these owls from being bulldozed in their burrows by a developer. And that was my childhood in West Broward County, fighting, we didn't fight. We didn't know how to fight, but all I knew is one day these owls were everywhere, and the next day it was poured concrete, and they buried the owls and the babies in the nests, and it was all perfectly legal back then. So I wanted to write a novel where it didn't end that way. I wanted to change that memory of my childhood a little bit. And I had no idea the book would take off the way they did. I had no idea they would make a movie out of it. But the most rewarding part of it all was the letters. And I've written two kids' books since. And the letters I get from these, I'm a cynical SOB, as you can probably imagine. But the letters from these kids from all over the world, the book is published in like 30 languages as well. And I get letters from all over the world. Kids that have never set foot in Florida, have never seen a burrowing owl, have never seen the Everglades, have never seen the Atlantic Ocean, but they have the common bond. There is some place that is special to them. There is some part of their lives, whether it's a meadow, a stream, a little brook that they played in. There is something that they cling to and that they cherish and that they feel is being threatened in some way. And that's how they connect with these novels. And the letters they send me, and I get thousands of them, are so full of hope and so full of energy. And they're much more sophisticated than I was when I was 11 or 12 about these things, that I find myself, against my own best judgment, moving forward with actual hope in my heart, thinking that these are the folks that are going to be running the planet in a few years. And if we don't beat it out of them in our educational system, in our business system, that it's not a bad thing to care about our air and our water and our wildlife, there might actually be hope. And so I found myself in some sense of redemption writing these kids' books. I cleaned them up, obviously. They're safe. It's been probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done, second to the newspaper column. I'll tell you one story because I get, and then I was told to take a few questions, which I'll do. I'll finish with one story. I get asked a lot, how does the journalism, how does the news business feed the fiction writing? What is the connection between writing the column and writing these crazy novels? And while I don't model any characters in the novels after real-life characters, I'm certainly inspired and jazzed up by just reading the Miami Herald on any given day. There's six novels you could pick out of any one of the, usually like page 6B. You can usually get your teeth into something that is going to be either a Fellini movie or a novel. But give you an example. I like in my novels... for nature to get revenge sometimes. I like the eminence of a hurricane or a natural event, or you know, I mentioned the python earlier. That's a scene I may play with a little bit. I just like the idea of somebody getting snatched by a python. I always root for the alligator, by the way. I know it's a terrible thing, and if you all have poodles and little dogs, I don't mean anything bad by it, but there's something glorious about an alligator on the prowl. So a few years ago, if you all who are not in Florida, you may not have this where you live. We have these exhibits in Florida where you can swim with a real bottlenose dolphin. You can get in a tank with a real bottlenose dolphin. And you pay, it's like $150. You hop in the tank and the dolphins. And by the way, this is the highlight of every dolphin's day. Yeah, yeah. About 75 tourists. There's some guy in a tank top squealing like Ned Beatty in Deliverance, okay? That's the highlight of your freaking day, is to have him grab onto your dorsal fin and start squealing about Flipper, all right? That's Florida. Anyway, a few years ago, something started happening at these exhibits. It was amazing. The Herald is a family newspaper, so what we called it euphemistically in our news stories was the dolphins start exhibiting aggressive behavior towards some of the tourists. Aggressive behavior. It was more than aggressive behavior. It was a manifestation of physical attraction towards some of the tourists, particularly the female tourists. This was a terrifying thing. A male dolphin can be up to 800 pounds, and frankly, they're endowed proportionately, okay? So there was terror at these theme parks, absolute terror, partly because some of these encounters, they would videotape them for you, so you can just imagine. This was before YouTube, by the way, thank God. Anyway, so as fast as I could, the journalistic side of me, I tracked down a woman who had gone to one of these operations in Key Largo for her birthday and had gotten a surprise like no other. And I interviewed her for a column, which I slammed into the paper as fast as I could. I see it as my duty to tourists, of all the other hazards you face in Florida, getting goosed by Flipper, right to the top of the list, in my view. But at the same time, I was in the middle of a novel, and the novel, there reaches a point in every novel where I have to get rid of a bad guy. I have to get rid of him. This is not a very literary explanation, but I do. I have to clear him off the stage. And so I had invented this phony theme park down in North Key Largo, the Amazing Kingdom of Thrills. And it was a cheap theme park. They had gotten all these rogue, they had a bad killer whale that had been bounced around from all over the place. They had a dolphin, Dickie the Dolphin was in a tank. So I'm inspired now by the real life antics of dolphins. And I have a bad guy, and he's going to have a fist fight on the catwalk with two of my good guys. And the bad guy was addicted to steroids to the extent that he literally dragged an IV drip around with him the whole time. He was an ex-cop. He was hooked. This was before Michael Jackson. I don't know if he got the idea from me or not. I don't know. But anyway, so there's a fist fight. The bad guy takes a punch from one of my good guys, and he goes cartwheeling with the IV thing trailing after him into Dickie the Dolphin's tank. And it's a moonlit night. It's handled very tastefully, this scene. I don't want you to be too appalled. It's a moonlit night in Key Largo, and the bad guy is, how do I put this? He's romanced to death by Dickie the Dolphin. As I said, it was almost a Disney moment, as clear as I could come to it. But in my sick world, though, I can name about 100 people that would be too good an ending for in terms of what has been done to Florida. You all have been very patient, and I'm glad you held your dinners down after this. I promise to take a few questions, which I'm happy to do, and I'll be as offensive as possible.
Thank you very much. Carl Hyacin, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. First question comes from Robert McClure, former Sun Sentinel reporter.
Hi, Robert McClure, Miami native, like you, now living sensibly in the Pacific Northwest. I wanted to let you know I really appreciate your newspaper column. I really appreciate your novels. And I just I would like to call to people's attention here that once upon a time, you were involved in a really important project with the Miami Herald, and that preserved a huge amount of this massive, this beautiful forest, a massive amount, the biggest one left in North Key Largo. And so, you know, you pretend to be, you've done so many great things in there, but for those of us who were around here and who knew Eddie Gong and people like that, okay, that's an important thing. And I just want to say that to everyone in this room, because we're here learning to do what we do. And Carl is one of these people who went from being a really good investigative reporter to doing so much more. But it started with the investigative reporting.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Give us an overview of that. Tell us what happened.
Very nice. Thank you. Thanks.
Give us a summary of that, Carl, because a lot of people don't know what you did.
Years ago, a reporter named Brian Duffy and myself were down in the Keys working on a project. There's a section of Card Sound Road and that leads down to North Key Largo, and we discovered it. They were going to put in 20,000 to 40,000 condominium units in the most sensitive mangrove hammock, really, in the state. And on the one side is the John Pennekamp State Park, the only living coral reef. And on the other side is Crocodile Lakes Wildlife Refuge, a refuge for endangered crocodiles. And all this had, I know shockingly, sailed through the Monroe County Commission. Literally, we put a stopwatch on one of the meetings, and it was in less than 3 minutes discussion. They approved the biggest development project at that time, and one of them in the history of Florida, without even looking at the plans. So we wrote about it. It got subsequently hung up in a variety of hearings and things like that, and then the company that was going to do it went bankrupt. So I can't take full credit, but it was every time I come out of the Keys now, I go up County Road 905 and cut across the Card Sound Bridge, and it's still green, and they still haven't screwed it up, but it was a lot of good people were involved in that fight.
Marvelous.
Thanks.
Marvelous. Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Susan Jewell. I'm the author of Exploring Wild South Florida and co-contributor with you to the anthology Book of the Everglades. You mentioned pythons, that you like to write about pythons. In 2004, you wrote Skinny Dip. Mm. And in that book, you probably know where I'm going with this. In that book, one of your characters, Detective Holvag, had two pythons that he kept in his apartment in South Florida, which escaped from their cages. And he couldn't find them for a while, and he feared that they had killed the neighbor's cat or something. And because he didn't want that to happen anymore, he let the pythons go in the Everglades.
Yep.
Not just anywhere in the Everglades. I noticed it specified Loxahatchee, where I used to be the senior biologist and I know of the National Wildlife Refuge, and I know it's illegal to release anything.
So let's
what's the
anyway,
point?
Anyway,
yes.
So I was wondering, using what you've learned, we've all learned about pythons since 2004. And
let me interrupt you for a second and say that my characters do all kinds of stupid things, and I'm not accountable for that. Okay, that's why it's called fiction.
Nevertheless, using your vast influence over the public, could you write a book that sets a good example against
I've written books that have set a lot of good examples, but my characters cannot always be perfect, and they weren't. And if I could write a chapter saying, and then the pythons were found by biologists and euthanized and necropsied, which is what happens next. But the kids might get a little squeamish about that, you know. But anyway, thanks.
Next question over here, please.
Hi, Brad Johnson with Think Progress. I have to admit, I'm one of those people who know you mostly as an author of very funny novels, so it's nice to know that you have a sideline in reporting.
Yeah.
And kind of in kind of on that, this may be coming from left field, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on kind of what the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Miami, because it kind of feels almost like something that you'd write into a book.
Well, I certainly there's an amorphous feel to it. I think it's a good thing that anybody's out in the streets these days, because when I was young, everybody was out in the streets, and that was the war in Vietnam. That was different. This is a pain that is more difficult to nail down, and I think you have a lot of people who can't find work that are frustrated. You have a lot of people upset, certainly by the disparity, the growing disparity in income between high income and the middle income. But I don't know that it has a unified voice yet, and that's what I think a lot of people are waiting to see. It just shows you where we are in the country, and it's good. It's good that all of us, not just political candidates or politicians, but all of us look out the window and see. This is what's happening. This is the pain on Main Street now. Now, again, the leadership is more. I'm not sure what some of it is about, and I think it will. I think it will grow leadership in time. But I right now, I'm like everybody else. I'm watching and waiting to see. You know. Yeah.
Yes. Last question. Yeah. Sorry, Billy and Seth.
Yeah, we have. You have much more important guests than me. The Cousteaus are here, and I'm taking up their time.
Hi, I'm Lynn Cherry, and the producer director of a series of Young Voices on the Planet. And you mentioned that kids give you hope. So, could you share with us some of the stories? You said these kids wrote thousands of letters of success stories. Some of these kids have done, maybe inspired by what you've written?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you anything specific that an 11-year-old has done to stop a $20 million apartment project, no. But I can tell you that they're starting to show up at meetings, that they're writing letters to the editor, that they're asking their parents questions, that they are reading and informing themselves about things that are going on in their communities and neighborhoods. There's just a level of awareness there that I know I didn't have when I was 11 or 12 years old. I mean, I had my bicycle and a fishing rod, and I was just riding past these places that were disappearing every single day. And I didn't know, it wouldn't even thought of how do you stop it or how do you have any input into that process. Kids today, and a lot of it's the internet. A lot of it is to be able to connect on the internet with folks that feel the same way. What I like is the energy. I like their incredible energy and optimism. And this is what we're doing in our class, and this is what we're doing, this is what my parents and I are doing. And a lot of it, again, isn't attached to one place, whether it's a letter I get from Tokyo or Vancouver or Cleveland, Ohio. It's this attachment to a sense of outdoors and place. It's the reason why waterfront real estate is more valuable, because the soothing nature of being face-to-face with nature. It's the reason Florida exists, frankly, is the idea, what were they selling? They were selling tropical paradise. And the idea that then let's pave it and destroy it or subdivide it or timeshare it, aside from the general obscenity of it, it sort of misses the whole big picture. But as I said, I'm not clicking my heels and doing cartwheels, but the letters do. They are very meaningful and stirring and exciting to me, and I'm sure that the Cousteau family gets more of that input than I do even. That's why you go on. It's why you get up in the morning. It's why you write what you write. It's why all of you do what you do. Some days you're feeling like you're pushing a boulder up a hill, but some days the boulder goes to the other side of the hill and you've made it. It's just, if you win 1 out of 10, you're doing great. Mm-hmm. Listen, thank you all for putting up with
it. Thank you very much. Carl Hiaasen. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much.